have reduced this story to just one woman, to Amelia Earhart.
Remembering the first female aviation pioneers who weren't named Earhart. It's Friday, August 31st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, new questions about what to call the Rohingya crisis. North Korea creating tension between the U.S. and China, and getting China's family planners out of the bedroom. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Beijing was quick to respond to President Donald Trump's criticism of China for North Korea's lack of movement toward denuclearization. Mr. Trump linked trade tensions with Beijing to the absence of progress with Pyongyang since his June summit in Singapore with leader Kim Jong-un.
Part of the North Korean problem is caused by our trade disputes with China. China's been taking out about $500 billion a year from the United States for many years, and we can't let that happen. As you know, China is the route to North Korea. 93% of the product and various things that go into North Korea go in through China. So I think that now that we're in somewhat, I don't like to call it a trade war, and I think, you know, our country is doing very well, but China's having a very, very tough time. And I think that China makes it much more difficult in terms of our relationship with North Korea.
In a tweet, Mr. Trump noted his very good and warm relationship with the North Korean leader, said there is no reason at this time to spend large amounts of money on joint U.S.-South Korean war games. Now, this comes just a day after his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, said there were no plans to suspend the exercises with South Korea next year. Grant Newsham is a Tokyo-based senior researcher fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He told VOA's Victor Beatty this might be a U.S. strategy that allows the president room to maneuver.
I think if one looks at the words carefully, he's saying, boy, how much he would really, really like to not do the exercises if Mr. Kim cooperates. But if Mr. Kim does not cooperate, then sort of the mother of all exercises are coming. You know, it really does, I think, give the other side a real pause for concern as to what the Americans really mean. Usually that's not the case, so maybe it's a good thing that Mr. Trump is actually making the North Koreans and, more importantly, the Chinese have to figure out what exactly the Americans have got going on and what they're thinking.
The president also took aim at China, blaming it in part for North Korea's lack of progress on denuclearization, and for the first time he linked it to the trade tensions with the U.S.
Yes, I think Mr. Trump is, and his administration or his advisors, they're irked by the Chinese. I think they're pretty upset that the Chinese have pretty much taken off all the restraints, mostly on sanctions against North Korea. How it would fit in with the trade negotiations, that remains to be seen. But I think that, too, is something of diplomatic speak or almost a negotiating ploy, to back foot or wrong foot the Chinese and make them figure out if there's some incredible deal they could offer the Americans and to sort of get the Americans off their back.
This all comes, of course, following his decision last week to cancel Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's fourth trip this year to Pyongyang.
Yes, I think it shows that this president is not going to be strung along. As in the past, Americans would generally send a Secretary of State or whomever, and they would go trying to figure out what they could offer North Korea, what sort of presence, what sort of deal they could offer them to get the North Koreans to cooperate. Here, when the North Koreans play their usual games of using vitriolic language against the Americans, Mr. Trump and his advisors say, okay, well, we're not coming. And that is a change from how things have customarily worked between the United States and North Korea.
And also this week, Japan, in its defense white paper, suggested that North Korea still seems to be the number one security issue that it faces.
That's a bit of creative reading of the Japan white paper. Yes, they do say that North Korea is an immense problem, an immediate problem for Japan. And they use some softer language towards China. But the bottom line, the real thinking within the Abe administration is that China is as much a threat as North Korea is, and maybe even a bigger one, in the sense that China poses really an existential threat to Japan and could certainly displace Japan as a country really of any account in Asia, and it does threaten to seize and occupy Japanese territory. Of course, North Korea nuclear weapon hitting Tokyo would be an existential threat as well. But I think that actually the Japanese government regards these as equal threats, but it's trying to use a little bit nicer language, hoping that the Chinese might appreciate the conciliatory tone to it.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert Wednesday reaffirmed that denuclearization must come ahead of other issues such as peace declarations to end the Korean War. These are among the top Asia stories right now on VOANews.com. An edict issued by Indonesia's top Muslim clerical body declares the measles vaccine forbidden by Islam. Pakistan vows in upcoming talks with the United States to mend strained relations, despite a row over a recent phone call between new Prime Minister Imran Khan and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. As many as 85 villages were flooded in Myanmar after a dam failed, forcing more than 63,000 people from their homes. And there are new calls to name a street in Hanoi after the recently departed and former Vietnamese war prisoner, Senator John McCain. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And VOA News continues. An estimated 700 tons of trees are cut each day around Cox's Bazar to provide Rohingya refugees fuel for cooking. Now NGOs are working together to provide training and gas stoves to curb the environmental damages and dangers of collecting firewood. Steve Sanford has this update from the refugee camps.
On the edges of the Rohingya refugee camps, the trees are quickly disappearing as demand for cooking fuel rises. For youngsters like Fatima Kalam, the adverse effects of collecting and using firewood takes its toll on family members.
We are without wood supplies and our hut is very hot, especially when we cook inside. I have to go into the forest to get the wood and it usually takes 2 or 3 hours. On the way, I step on many sharp objects and it hurts.
In the hillside settlements, the depletion of the forests, including dug-up roots, increases the risks of landslides. A cooperative of aid groups are aiming to supply at least 200,000 homes with a cleaner solution that will have ripple effects on the environment.
The refugees are cooking on inefficient mud stove that causes a lot of smokes. So that comes with a subsequent health hazard as well. So LPG is a clean fuel that will solve this issue.
For some recipients of the new cooking gear, the added benefits might just put more food on the table. Natawan Mondul says in the past, she had to sell some of her food because of a lack of firewood to cook it with.
They have people who donate food supplies and other necessities. If I have extra donations, I can sell them in the market and use the money to buy more firewood. Sometimes I have to borrow firewood from my neighbor, and it is difficult for me.
As LPG distribution expands in the camps, aid groups are hopeful that it will ease the demands of a limited environment. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Happening now in Asia, foreign exchange markets were warming up in Asia on Thursday after major moves during the previous session by the pound and the euro. Japan's yen was basically flat. However, the Australian dollar dropped 0.3% and New Zealand's dollar dropped 0.8%. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
And VOA Asia continues. A year after a crackdown on Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar caused 700,000 people to flee into neighboring Bangladesh, UN investigators are accusing top military officials in Myanmar of genocide and other human rights abuses. VOA's Jesus Oni explores the ongoing refugee crisis in Bangladesh.
A UN panel of investigators for the first time Monday calling for Myanmar's military leaders to be prosecuted for war crimes and genocide. The UN report comes 1 year after the brutal military crackdown against Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar that resulted in about 700,000 refugees fleeing for their safety into neighboring Bangladesh.
I mean, that is a word that should not be used lightly. There was a conscious effort to displace, murder, and rape these individuals. If it isn't a genocide, nothing qualifies.
According to the report, the violence, a military retaliation to attacks by Rohingya rebels last August, was grossly disproportionate.
We heard terrifying stories. One woman after the other talked about being raped by multiple members of the military, seeing babies thrown onto burning bonfires. We heard about police shooting children as they ran away. Just absolutely horrendous atrocities.
Karim, a Rohingya refugee from Myanmar, says the violence was intentional.
It's discrimination to the Rohingya people, and they're planning to drive out Rohingya from the country.
Myanmar has denied accusations of systematic ethnic cleansing.
From the beginning, we have rejected the fact-finding mission that is mandated by the United Nations Human Rights Commission. I can tell you that military is doing what they should do according to the code of conduct.
Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, the country's moral authority and de facto leader, has also come under fire for her silence on the plight of the Rohingya.
Well, I can certainly tell you that the impression many of us had of her and her courage when she was confined by the Myanmar military has changed dramatically because of this Rohingya crisis. We expected more. We expected her to step up and at least speak out against this atrocity.
The Trump administration has issued sanctions against some of Myanmar's military commanders, but activists say it's not enough.
We need to go back to what worked. Full sanctions worked before. This did not happen then, and we believe we, the United States, needs to make full sanctions against the Burmese government.
Despite difficult conditions in many of the refugee camps in Bangladesh, activists say a climate of fear prevents many refugees from returning to what is left of their homes in Myanmar. Jesus Amaoni, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Boeing forecasts that the Asia-Pacific region will need 240,000 more pilots by 2037. China alone will need half of these new personnel. The projections place pressure on the industry, already struggling with a pilot shortage. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The state-run China Daily said Wednesday removing stipulations regarding family planning from a proposed civil code does not mean China is abandoning its family planning policy. Such language has been deleted from a draft of the marriage section of the code to be adopted by the National People's Congress in 2020. It also contains a one-month cooling-off period in which couples filing for divorce can withdraw their case. China is facing a demographic crisis in coming years as it tries to balance a growing population with one that is rapidly aging combined with a shrinking workforce. Reggie Littlejohn is the Maryland-based founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She told VOA's Victor Beatty that while an NPC commission said the changes are subject to further consideration, she doubts decades of strict family planning can continue.
I personally think that the Chinese government has no choice but to end a course of population control. But there's just been really conflicting reports coming out in the media. Because on Monday, as you know, there was a Weibo tweet to the effect that family planning law was being left out of the draft. And then on Tuesday, the new news is, yeah, it was just left out of the marriage section. That doesn't mean it's going to be left out entirely. So we don't really know where they stand on this.
Well, we know what the trend is. We had the one-child policy that was put into effect with forced sterilizations and forced abortions and heavy fines in 1979. The limit was raised to two children just 2 years ago. The nation is facing a rapidly aging population. So the reasons behind this potential change in family planning policy are pretty practical, aren't they?
Absolutely. I don't think that the Chinese government has a choice other than to abolish coercive family planning. But my concern is that the new rule will be simply that all couples can have as many children as they want, as opposed to all people, because a vast number of unmarried women in China are still subject to forced abortion because it remains illegal in China for an unmarried woman to have a baby. In the United States, almost 40% of our births are to unmarried women. So we do not consider this to be a complete victory until all women are allowed to have as many children as they want.
No matter what the actual policy ends up stating, couples in China apparently are in no rush to enlarge their families.
That is correct. And that is the reason that they are thinking of abolishing coercive family planning altogether, is that they had expected many more people to have a second child under the two-child policy. People are not having a second child because it's very expensive and very time-consuming, and the Chinese government has done such a good job of beating it into people's heads that one child is best, and a lot of people just don't want a second child. So now they're almost in a situation of being desperate to increase the young population to support their rapidly aging population.
Two Chinese academics caused quite a stir on social media earlier this month when they proposed couples with only one or no children should pay a tax-like maternity fund.
What that does is it would penalize people who have chosen to have fewer than two children and force them to support families that have more children. This is just the Chinese government continuing to meddle in women's wombs. They continue to regard women's bodies as the domain of the state, either to crush their fertility if that serves them, or to pressure them into fertility if that serves them. Chinese womb police need to get out of the bedrooms of Chinese women.
And you're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia, Australia says it will take a leading role in forging an EU-style free trade agreement in Asia. This is the world reels from a tit-for-tat trade dispute between the two world's two superpowers, China and the U.S. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the world remembers aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart, who vanished on around the world flight in 1937. But there are other prominent American female pilots in the 20s and 30s who were groundbreakers as well, including Arkansas-born Louise Thaden and New Yorker Ruth Nichols. Author Keith O'Brien is bringing fresh attention to these women aviators in his new book, Fly Girls. It's now a New York Times bestseller. He spoke with VOA's Sarah Williams, who asked him why the lesser-known women pilots are often overlooked.
You know, I think in the decades that have passed since this time and since Amelia's disappearance, we have reduced this story to just one woman, to Amelia Earhart. You know, she was the most famous of them all, certainly by 1937 when she disappeared. And her disappearance added mystery and legend to her fame. You know, in its years after she disappeared, there was, of course, much interest about what happened to her. And her husband, it should be noted, George Putnam, formerly of Putnam Publishing, he also did what he could to keep her name in the news. And I think the combination of her fame, the mystery around her disappearance, and Putnam's interest in keeping her famous even after she had gone sucked all the oxygen out of the room and ultimately reduced this story of women in aviation to just one, when really that wasn't the case at all.
I didn't realize until reading your book that part of Earhart's first solo flight, her first transatlantic solo flight to Europe, was done by a man named Bernt Balchen, who was from Norway. He was, I guess, a consultant for her. He actually flew the plane. Earhart was with him. He flew the plane from New Jersey to Canada, to New Brunswick and Newfoundland. And then from Newfoundland, Earhart took over. But I was never even aware of that.
Yeah, we have erased that bit of the story, haven't we? You know, and that is significant. You know, she does fly solo from Newfoundland to Ireland, and so that is a solo Atlantic crossing. But Bernt Balchen was not just a male aviator. He was one of the most experienced flyers and ocean aviators in the world at that time. And he does fly her plane all the way to Newfoundland. And it's significant because Ruth Nichols, just 1 year earlier, tried to beat Earhart across the ocean, tried to make this solo flight, and she was going by herself. And Ruth Nichols does suffer a mishap in Canada on one of her refueling stops, which was not that uncommon at the time. And it's because of that mishap, because of happenstance and poor luck and a bit of poor planning, that Ruth Nichols doesn't get across the ocean first. And when Earhart makes her attempt 1 year later in 1932, Putnam, who of course has his hands in everything that Earhart does, wants to take no chances here. And so it's Bernt Balchen who's going to fly that plane up the coast all the way to Newfoundland.
Also, your book describes in detail the danger in flying. It's tremendously dangerous for both for men and for women. And then there's, of course, the horrible case of Florence Klingensmith, who was piloting a GB plane and was killed in an air race near Chicago.
It was incredibly dangerous at this time, especially air racing. Inevitably, pilots flying oftentimes single-propeller, open-cockpit machines would crash. I mean, they're flying at a high rate of speed, low to the ground, in competitive races. This was extremely dangerous. It was dangerous for the men. It was dangerous for the women. But there was a double standard. When a man crashed or died, as often happened in these races, he was hailed as a hero and often given grand tributes and memorials right there on the field with flybys and 21-gun salutes and ashes scattered, you know, from the sky. And when a woman crashed or died in the races, as sadly would happen, she often didn't even get the most basic, decent human respect. Instead of being hailed as a hero, instead of being given grand tributes, the women who crashed and died were sometimes blamed for their own failures and blamed in the press. It was really infuriating to read how they were treated during this time.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, of course, Amelia Earhart vanished. Louise Thaden eventually left flying. She was married and had young children. And later on, unfortunately, Ruth Nichols killed herself. But certainly, looking back on these women, in so many ways, they were ahead of their times. They also, though, when you think about it, they really lived on the edge.
They were living on the edge. This was to be a woman in the late 1920s, not just flying planes, but racing planes, put you in a very small group of people. It made you a true radical, a real renegade. They absolutely were living on the edge. And they would all go missing, really, in their own way. You know, Amelia, of course, disappears. Others disappear right before our eyes. And that's not just something that happened. After the air racing time is over, after this decade ends, these experienced female aviators, they can't get a job doing the thing they love. They can't get hired at the airlines. Some of them can't even get hired to be flight instructors. The sexism and discrimination remained, and it made it hard for a lot of these women. You know, Ruth Nichols wasn't the only early female aviator who struggled after the spotlight turned away. A lot of them did because they couldn't get hired to do the thing they loved.
Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girl, speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Well, that's VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thanks so much for being with us. Hope you join us again on Monday. And until then, have a great weekend.